You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the SEA. You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the SEA.
Hello and welcome to episode 257 of the Fabulous Pelton Cast, sponsored by our friends at Pagliacci Pizza. I'm your co-host, Kevin Pelton.
I'm Tristan Carcino.
And we are coming to you as usual in different locations. I'm in Boulevard Park, Washington, home of the Pelton Cast.
I'm coming to you from Renton, Washington, home of the Super Bowl 48 champion Seattle Seahawks. And I think before we get into anything here today, just want to send our thoughts and prayers to the family of young Dante Wright and the community in Brooklyn Center, Minnesota. Just another senseless act earlier this week that has become all too familiar in American society. And it's clear to me that in the wake of George Floyd's murder almost a year ago, that if this can happen again in the very same community, that the system that we live in and the prejudices that exist, both in American society in general and in policing, that the system cannot be fixed and needs to be completely broken down and rethought structurally.
And it's disappointing that the momentum that existed last summer in the protests in the wake of George Floyd's murder seems to have dissipated in terms of the energy from change. You know, obviously there is a contingent of people pushing for change, but you know, the majority of people have kind of moved on, and that's the reason that these structures continue to exist in the way that they do. We're also this week, before we get started, thinking of Sonics great Slick Watts after he suffered a major stroke last Friday. His son, former UW guard Donald Watts, said on Twitter that Slick is, quote, in stable condition on a long road to recovery. And this is the Pelton Cast Hall of Fame episode. We're going to introduce the nominees for our 2021 Hall of Fame class and thought it was appropriate to announce Slick is a direct elect selection for this second Pelton Cast Hall of Fame class.
Absolutely.
Slick Watts arrived in Seattle after going undrafted out of HBCU Xavier University of Louisiana, wow, following which the only Catholic HBCU, as far as I'm aware. Following his head coach there, Bob Hopkins, who joined his cousin Bill Russell as an assistant coach when Russell was named the new Sonics head coach, Slick made the team against tough competition, quickly emerged as a beloved figure in Seattle sports during an era where the Sonics were the only pro team in town, with his style of play and signature combination of the shaved head, rare for the time, and the off-kilter headband. Slick led the NBA in both assists per game and steals per game in 1975-76, becoming the first player ever to do both of those things the same season. Also won the J. Walter Kennedy Citizenship Award that same season. Slick's playing time declined in 1977-78 after Lenny Wilkins replaced Hopkins following Hopkins' brief stint as head coach. He was traded to New Orleans in January 1978, months before the Sonics reached the NBA Finals, but returned to Seattle after his NBA career ended in 1979 and has become an institution in the local basketball community.
Absolutely. I mean, a no-brainer for the Pelton Cast Hall of Fame. Somebody who you mentioned as an institution in Seattle basketball, but also the lineage of having his son, Donald Watts, be the star of the UW basketball team that I think kind of made us fall in love with UW basketball to begin with in the 90s. Slick is somebody who you would see at Sonics games, you would see at community events, you'd see around town, and just and still is, for the record. But one of the most recognizable figures in Seattle basketball and in basketball in general, with that trademark look and just the perfect name, Slick Watts. Come on.
I mean, it's an iconic look that is instantly recognizable. And yeah, like you said, continued to be a presence in the Seattle basketball community well after the Sonics move, certainly at Storm games. I know a couple of times I had the pleasure of judging Storm slam dunk contests next to Slick Watts, which is amazing on, wow, and bizarre on so many levels.
There and, it is.
Yeah. Yeah. I had to get the name drop in at some point. And if that wasn't enough.
Who was a tougher judge, you or Slick?
I can't say I remember that specifically. I assume Sean Kemp was the toughest judge because, you know, when you've actually been in.
You already named Drops like once, and so you had to work in that you were also judging with Sean Kemp, too.
But if all of that wasn't enough to put Slick in the Pelton Cast Hall of Fame, he also happens to be the namesake of our theme song. So that's just kind of the topper on that argument.
When I think because of all those reasons that we talked about, he is the namesake of the theme song, right? Like it all makes sense. And with Blue Scholars going into the Hall of Fame last year, it makes total sense for Slick Watts to go into the Hall of Fame this year.
Absolutely. So we'll talk a little bit later about some other nominees to potentially join Slick and those original selections in the Pelton Cast Hall of Fame. But now let's talk about our beers. And this time we have not managed to successfully coordinate beers this week.
I tried to give you one of these at Easter and you refused. Well, I am drinking the Sierra Nevada Wanderland Nectarine Ale. And I mentioned to you that I've never seen a nectarine ale before. And you said you have definitely drank a nectarine ale before. So if you want to go look this up while I read about it.
Yeah, I have not reviewed my spreadsheet, but I'll go now.
Set out and see where the adventure leads. Roam until your paradise appears, like this juicy golden sunset of a brew. Take it all in with an aroma of just picked fruit, bold hop flavor, and a bright burst of nectarine. Enjoy the ride.
Okay, I'm searching through this. I have not yet found nectarine, so maybe it's untrue. Maybe I'm making this up.
You did hit control and then F and then type in nectarine.
I have to go. There's different sheets for each year, so I have to go through each of the different sheets, obviously. Since you went with nectarine instead, I'm going with peach in the Sun Glitter Peach IPA from our friends at Silver City Brewing, which I'm sure we've done on this podcast before, possibly multiple times, but always a classic. We have several toasts to get to this week. Let's start with to Seattle native Rick Welts, who is stepping down as president and COO of the Warriors at the end of this season. Announced that last week. Welts, who was elected to the Naismith Memorial Basketball Hall of Fame, has spent 46 years as an NBA executive between teams in the league office. The Queen Anne High School and UW grad started his career as a ball boy and later PR director for the Sonics, and was instrumental in the Warriors playing a preseason game in Seattle in October 2018, the last sporty event at Key Arena before the process of rebuilding as Climate Pledge Arena began.
I guarantee you have read those exact credentials on the Pelton Cast before.
When we were talking about him being elected to the Hall of Fame, yes, although not probably the part about the game in Seattle at that point.
That time you just did the Control C, Control V. From your old notes. I just remember the Queen Anne High School grad in particular.
Oh, that's weird because I wrote that fresh. That was not in the original draft of this of this toast.
I mean, he has been an executive in the NBA long enough that he went to a high school that no longer exists.
And overlapped, presumably, during his career with Slick Watts. He was definitely PR director when they won the championship. So I'm certain might have been both ball boy and in the front office during Slick Watts' career. Some unfortunate news to start UW spring practice last week as we learned that outside linebacker Liatu Latu has medically retired after undergoing neck surgery. In ESPN 300 recruit in 2019, Latu had 15 tackles and a half sack as a true freshman and was expected to assume a starting role in 2020 prior to his injury. That, of course, opened the door for Zion Tupuola-Fatui's breakthrough campaign. So the Huskies are deep at the position with fifth-year senior Ryan Bowman returning, redshirt freshman Savell Smalls, and incoming transfer Jeremiah Martin. But still tremendously disappointing that we're not going to get to see what Latu could have accomplished on the field as part of that group. And he will stay with the team as a student assistant. And staying on Montlake, UW volleyball coach Keegan Cook was awarded Pac-12 Coach of the Year for the first time after the Huskies won the Pac-12 title, while LMA Powell won the conference's Setter of the Year award.
There we go.
Which is a thing that exists, apparently. Powell was also one of three Huskies named to the All-Pac-12 team, along with outside hitters Samantha Dreskel and Claire Hoffman. The Huskies will start the NCAA tournament Thursday when they'll face the winner of Wednesday's first-round match between Dayton and Towson.
All right. There we go. Bring on Towson.
Okay, lastly, big news from the world of H1 Unlimited Hydroplane Racing is Dave Vilwak is back. in the cockpit for the first time since being suspended at 2014 Seafair for accumulating two Category 5 penalties in back-to-back weeks. I'm not sure how the categories work, but I'm confident that Category 5 is bad. He'll be driving the Bucket List Racing hydroplane this season, which is set to begin June 26th and 27th at Lake Guntersville in Alabama. So Phil Walk looking to add to his record as the winningest hydroplane racer of all time.
I'm trying to think of any other athlete who's had a seven-year absence like that. This is longer than Jordan coming back with the Wizards, right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, Jordan was out 3 years. I mean, it's sometimes happened, I think, but it's pretty uncommon.
This is the only thing I can think of is like Gordie Howe playing one game when he was 80 years old or whatever to play in six different decades. That's like what Dave Vilwalk is trying to do here.
I wouldn't go quite that far. But
how many decades is Dave Vilwalk? He's only got the 90s, the 2000s, the 2010s, and the 2020s. Is that what he's trying to do here? He's trying to get four decades in?
That would be four decades, yes. Okay, as mentioned, let's talk about this year's nominees for the Pelton Cast Hall of Fame. Is a refresher. Last year's inaugural class featured Ken Griffey Jr.
There we go.
Cube 93 FM, Loretta's Northwesterner, and Taco Time Northwest is direct elect choices. And then the listener voted in Blue Scholars, as you mentioned earlier, Sean Kemp and Gary Payton together, obviously, Rainier Beer, and Brandon Roy.
Just a hilariously random list of things.
I mean, a hilariously Pelton cast random list of things.
So in this Hall of Fame where we nominate restaurants, bars, athletes, sometimes buildings, which we'll get to.
Oh, yeah.
Architecture. We're could not above nominating architecture.
Inanimate objects.
We could have nominated just the Rainier R. I think that's still up for. Ooh. Rainier Beer is in. The Rainier R has not made it to the Hall of Fame yet.
That's a great idea for 2022. It's too late to be a nominee in 2021.
Oh, these are sentences. They've been typed into the Word doc.
You can't change them now. So we will have polls over the next few weeks here for at least two. Are we going to do four? Are we going to do two of each from each of these categories or one each?
I don't know.
I guess we'll see how the listener feedback goes.
The podcast Hall of Fame is a very, very loose Hall of Fame. The rules about it are ever changing.
You do have to be retired, we determined. So Isaiah Thomas was not eligible.
If you're an athlete. Now, correct. If you're an athlete or building, do you have to be retired?
A building does not have to be retired.
In the case of Rainier Beer, I guess that's the only thing to compare Dave Vilwalk to, is Rainier Beer went away for a period of time and then came back.
Well, the R went away.
They didn't make Rainier Beer for a chunk of time also, right?
Was there a period of time where Rainier Beer itself was literally not? I don't think that's the case.
I'm pretty sure there was a time when Rainier Beer was not.
I don't know how to research this, but I disagree with you.
I feel like it would not be that hard to research. The good podcasting would be just pausing but not editing the podcast while you do the research.
Oh, yeah. I mean, pauses so long that, you know, it's awkward and you're forced to check your phone. Those are apparently going to be in the Pelton Cast MVP voting, so we'll but see. Not the Pelton Cast Hall of Fame voting necessarily.
Okay. So we may be – I think we should do one from each of these categories.
Okay.
We don't need the bloat in – the Pelton Cast Hall of Fame.
It's a
right?
Small hall versus large hall debate.
We had a very large inaugural class for the Pelton Cast Hall of Fame, right?
Yes.
Which makes sense. There were some things that we had to get in there, right? Taco Time Northwest had to be in the Hall of Fame. And as always, this is presented by our good friends at Pagliacci Pizza, the Pelton Cast Hall of Fame, whether they know it or not.
Definitely doubt.
But now, as we enter into the second year of the Pelton Cast Hall of Fame, I think what we do is we have one direct elect, which will be Slick Watts for this year. We do one in the sports category and one in the non-sports category.
I think that keeps
it pretty tight. It'll give us a lot of nominees for a number of years. And there have to be some unfortunate decisions that are made. You know, Edgar Martinez so far in his second year of eligibility has not been nominated for the Pelton Cast Hall of Fame.
That is accurate.
So, and you only get a 10-year window.
No, it's an infinite window.
Oh, Lord.
Okay, let's start in the sports category. I believe carrying over from last season, Jermaine Kearse, receiver for both UW and the Seahawks, hashtag Kearse crew, coming from Lakes, Washington, like 206, I guess 253 as well. Puget Sound through and through, Jermaine Kearse.
425. I guess. Definitely no. Only 253. All right.
Wait, which part would that were you considering 425? I mean, he probably lives in the 425. I think the odds are very good that Jermaine Kearse lives there currently.
There we go. That's what I mean.
So that's something. All right, our next candidate, fitting this year.
Jermaine Kearse is one who, a little surprised he wasn't already in the, I checked the ledger and was a little surprised that Jermaine Kearse wasn't already in the Pelton Cast Hall of Fame.
I think that was a close vote last year between Brandon Roy and Jermaine Kearse for that second sports spot.
Split the vote.
They split the UW vote. Well, we're also going to split the UW vote again this year because fittingly, after we talked about him repeatedly during Let's Remember a Season, Nate Robinson is a candidate for the Pelton Cast Hall of Fame.
He is one of the few candidates that overlaps between Pelton Cast Hall of Fame, Let's Remember a Husky Season, and our search for Seattle's best fried chicken.
It's true. That's a good point.
A unique candidate.
Also overlaps UW football and UW men's basketball.
Really? The diversity that Nate Robinson comes to the Pelton Cast with.
He never got that chance. Never got that chance to play for the Seahawks like he was hoping, though. All right, our next.
I mean, if the Sonics were here for more than a handful of years when he was in the NBA, he would have ended up on the Sonics at some point.
One would think that we've really missed an opportunity. I mean, Jamal Crawford never playing for the Sonics, who, by the way, a future candidate in this for sure. He's not in this year's nominees, but definitely a candidate in the future. Our next nominee. Indeed, is a building. It's the kingdom.
There we go.
We've talked a lot about the kingdom on this podcast, including celebrating the 20th anniversary of its demolition earlier. Last year, with an interview with Kevin Artovitz and our discussion about the merits of the kingdom.
And another one housed at one point, the Sounders. Did they play in the kingdom?
The original NASL Sounders did for sure.
Seahawks, Mariners, and an occasional Sonics game.
Well, not in Ocasio. That was their primary home during the 78-79 season. So at that point, I believe all four of those teams were playing in the kingdom in 78-79.
A very impressive Speedwalker sketch.
yes. Oh, great one.
and an iconic ramp also, which just architecture-wise, you know, the Pelton Cast Hall of Fame, it's about athletes, it's about architecture, it's about food, and
I hope in the case of the kingdom, it's not about food.
That ramp is unparalleled in all of sport. A beautiful ramp on the kingdom.
The experience of walking outside of the kingdom on a beautiful sunny summer day and being shocked by the sun.
No! That's how baseball was meant to be experienced.
Oh boy.
Like, I hope the kingdom makes it. I'm pulling for the kingdom hard.
And then our last nominee in the sports category is,
it's really got no shot. This is, if only choosing one out of here, this is gonna be tough.
I mean, that's what you were saying. It's tough decisions if we're only choosing one, because we talked about a couple weeks ago, the best basketball player ever to play in Seattle, I think, is Lauren Jackson, three-time WNBA MVP, two-time champion with the Storm. Unfortunately, career cut short due to injuries. We've seen previously that did not affect Brandon Roy's Hall of Fame candidacy for the Pelton Cast. That can't be overcome. And she is actually a candidate for the Naismith Memorial Hall of Fame, which should be announcing their nominee, their finalists, or the selections, I should say, soon. She is a finalist.
And which would be more important to Lauren?
Oh, very similar, I'm sure. I mean, look, it's a lot more exclusive, the Pelton Cast Hall of Fame.
That is true. Yeah, that's a big Hall of Fame. Look, we keep it tight. on the PelotonCast Hall of Fame. It's reserved for only the finest buildings that caused a delay in a baseball team season. So.
All right, well, then the non-sports category.
Yes.
We start off with, this is actually sort of sports. So this is a little, we're already, as you mentioned.
I mean, the kingdom is sort, I feel like you could swap these two and it wouldn't be.
It's fluid, but we have Seafair as our first nominee in the non-sports category.
You had talked about specifically, you were like, maybe the Seafair hydroplanes, like we're not talking about the fucking soapbox derby here. I think that was a quote.
That may have come up. Milk carton derby, I believe, milk is what I was referencing them. But the Seafair Torchlight Parade may be part of the candidates here, I think. And okay, the Seafair clowns, for sure. And pirates. The pirates. Yeah.
They're clowns and pirates?
Yeah, they're both.
Oh, okay. Well, you know a lot more about Seafair than I do.
I'm pretty well versed in Seafair.
So this is everything. This is the hydroplane races. This is the log boom. This is the whole shebang, the weekend, literally the entire summer in Seattle. Because I think Seafair starts pretty early, right?
Yes.
This is the whole thing. This is all of Seafair. So
consider that as your vote in. Our next nominee.
So random.
Sir Mix-a-Lot.
Sir Mix-a-Lot.
You have nothing to add on Sir Mix-a-Lot?
This is such a ridiculous
of course
thing to be voting on. It's either a summer-long event in the city of Seattle that has existed for 70 years or something like that.
Approximately, yeah.
Or, and to me, maybe more important culturally, the artist who did Posse's on Broadway.
Exactly. Yes. Who introduced us all to the concept of going back the other way in Idiot Dicks. Which, by the way,
wow,
in an amazing professional segue that I did not think of until I was saying it in the moment, is our next nominee, of course, Dicks Driving.
There we go.
I mean, when you think of Seattle food, Dick's has to be near the very top of the list. There's a reason that hamburgers were for search, that Dick's was the popular vote winner of that competition in a landslide. I mean, it's Seattle through and through.
It's the most iconic Seattle food brand, in my opinion.
With all due respect to Azell's.
To Azell's and Pagliacci, but the Dick's name has lasted forever. And a fabulous experience. Every single location that you go to, growing a little bit lately, stretching to different corners of the Northwest and the greater Seattle area. But Dick's Burgers, something that every age is excited about and interested in going to. So curious to see how they fare versus the Summer Festival and the rapper who did the song Buttermilk Biscuits.
And also,
there we go,
the TV show that you referenced earlier, Almost Live. We, you know, did the interview with Pat Cashman last year talking about his experience on the show and his memories on the show as he was promoting the podcast series that he's been doing, Almost Live, Still Alive, which I've listened to, I think, every episode that's come out of that series. So it's been a lot of fun. That trip down memory lane, certainly formative for us in terms of our comedy and our stereotypes about Seattle neighborhoods that are long outdated.
There we go. All right. Those are the contenders. We have enshrined Slick Watts into the PelotonCast Hall of Fame. It is up to you now to choose who will be next in the sports corner. We have Super Bowl champion for the Seattle Seahawks, Husky legend, fixture of Seattle football, Jermaine Kearse. We have slam dunk champion, person who put UW basketball back on the map, and make some mean fried chicken, Nate Robinson.
Not anymore, sadly, but
we have the building that almost all of us, if you're as old as we are, grew up going to see almost every single professional sporting event at. It was beautiful. It had a ramp. It had the peanut guy, and Speedwalker saved it. That is the kingdom, or the greatest professional basketball player to have ever played in the city of Seattle from down under, Lauren Jackson. Those are the contenders in the sports category for PeltonCast Hall of Fame and in the non-sports category. A diverse group, to say the least. We have get off of your milk carton and come down for Seafair. That's right. You have to sit on an awkward grassy knoll to watch it. The planes are loud. Mercer Island is pissed. It is Seafair. There is.
Almost like probably did many jokes about Mercer Island residents being pissed.
You might know him from Baby Got Back, but we know him for Posse's on Broadway. That's right. The original Bremolo. It is Sir Mix-a-Lot and the most iconic fast food brand, food brand in Seattle history. They make a mean deluxe, a mean special, but don't ignore the cheeseburger. That's right. Dick's Drive-In. Or if you're old enough to remember, 11:30 p.m. on Saturday nights in the city of Seattle. It was not Saturday Night Live airing. It was not live here. Of course, also on the West Coast, it was never live. But 11:35 to 12:05 p.m., you tuned in for John Keister, for Pat Cashman, for Bob Nelson. That's right, almost live. A fixture of the 80s and the 90s in Seattle comedy and television. These are the contenders for PeltonCast Hall of Fame year 2. Who will it be?
I'm hyped about those descriptions. Now, should we resume our search for Seattle's best fried chicken?
Whew. All right.
I would say this may someday be a candidate for the PeltonCast Hall of Fame. Wow. I don't think it's going too far to say that because
this location.
Well,
I think you see what we're competing with right now. You're talking about a summer festival that has been going on for 70 years that our grandparents grew up going to.
I don't know if I'd say our grandparents grew up going to
Seafair. That our grandparents went to Seafair when they were young.
I mean, our mom was 51 the first Seafair. I got to double check that.
When you.
I thought, were you not saying something there?
We're young. Call me.
1950. So it was right before, the year before our mom was born.
An event that has been going on from before Jan was born. I don't know. Look, it's a very good restaurant that we went to, but these are pretty high stakes that you're talking about here.
I'm just saying, already the winner of one PeltonCast search and a plausible chance at being a winner of second PeltonCast search, Joe. And that is, of course, Ma'ono. A brief history of Ma'ono. Chef Mark Fuller opened the upscale Spring Hill restaurant in 2008 and served fried chicken based on his grandmother's Hawaiian recipe once a week on Mondays. The fried chicken
is Mark Fuller's connection to Hawaii.
That's where his I believe it's his mom's side of the family is from. So I don't know if he was raised there necessarily, but definitely. Like it is family connection. So that was so popular that the restaurant rebranded as Ma'ono in 2012, centered around the chicken and with more of a Hawaiian themed menu.
Yes. It
later expanded to chicken centric locations inside Rachel's Ginger Beer with that iconic chicken sandwich, a later addition to the menu, which was of course chosen Seattle's best sandwich in our 2019 search.
A disputed choice, but okay. By some.
Well, the decider and I were on the right side of history.
Decider and I. Okay. We have to see if the decider is going to be able to choose some fried chicken. I'm not sure.
I'm confident the decider can pull it together for that.
There we go. That's the confidence that I like to see. We'll see if he can help project those three draft picks the Seahawks have.
So Ma'ono traditionally has been where I have gone with friends for my birthday dinner in years prior to pandemic conditions. Last year, I don't believe they had reopened yet by my birthday. It might have just been reopening at that point, but the first time I went, I know, was the first day of the NFL draft last year, was the first time I got takeout from Ma'ono. So okay. This year, with them open, they're actually open for in-person dining in addition to takeout. Hatched a plan to go get some fried chicken from there and take it to a park, not Elkhi, but over in West Seattle, and look at the Puget Sound and eat fried chicken. And it seemed like a pretty great idea. And I think it worked out well, despite how windy it was.
Absolutely, it was. I don't think there's a time that I've not wanted to eat Maono fried chicken. I love the description and the history of Maono, because this is how restaurants should come to be, right? They just said, people love this. Why don't we build the whole restaurant out of the fried chicken? You know? It's just like, you do one thing excellent. Let's just do that. And there were some other things in that menu. There were some other things in that menu that were calling to me. I saw that Loco Moco and I was like, it wasn't quite hot enough. It was not quite hot enough to go with the Loco Moco just yet. But look, it was like 55 degrees.
You think Loco Moco is something you only eat when it's hot?
I think it would have tasted really nice if it was like 80 degrees.
I mean, I suppose its origins are Hawaiian. I mean, that does make sense, but it's not like, I don't know, it's not like gazpacho or something. I mean, the rest of the menu is quite great, and I'm sure it was at Spring Hill, which we never went to. I'm not sure when the first time was I went to Maono. I know the first time you went to Maono, because we've got a record of that was 2015.
That was 2015. Wow.
Yeah, it's,
it feels like it was recent. Maybe even longer than ago.
Right, it's more recent and longer after they rebranded and retooled than I expected.
Very drunk off bottomless mimosas.
That is accurate, yes.
Which distinctly remember taking a nap.
Sadly, are not on the menu for brunch anymore. I don't know if they were doing brunch. I don't think they are at this point with the reopening.
What even is there? Disqualified. In 70 years when they would be nominated for the Pelton Cast Hall of Fame. Gone from that too.
Wow. Yeah. Tough break. I feel like many of the fried chicken locations are not serving bottomless mimosas, so it's going to be tough for you to make this choice.
But an interesting synergy here, because that first time that I went to Maono was also the last time before this weekend that I had their bone-in fried chicken. So I've had it on both the first time that I've been to Maono and the most recent time that I've been to Maono. So we went with a couple of different types of chicken for this. The famous cousin Katie and Ben joined us. Both of them went with the chicken sandwich. Look, they know what the best sandwich in Seattle is. I don't blame them. You and I, though, we're all about the craft, right?
Well, we're all about chicken sandwiches not being eligible for the search for Seattle's best fried chicken.
And we said we have to push ourselves here, right? We know that a chicken sandwich is always great, but the heights that can be achieved by bone-in fried chicken can exceed the heights of a great chicken sandwich.
I just think we needed to do it for the search because the chicken sandwich was ineligible. So, I mean, what I would say is, like, I first went to Maono for the fried chicken, but once the chicken sandwich became an option at the fried chicken-centric locations at Rachel's, like, quick pivot to that and have not looked back in terms of eating the bone-in fried chicken. So I'm not sure when the last time was that I had it, but it's been a while for me.
And so we did the bone-in fried chicken, a half chicken, five pieces, and then also did the chicken strips just to try out a couple of different ways to have chicken. And I wanted to push you a little bit on the spice level.
You did. I'm normally a mild chicken sandwich orderer, but you convinced me to go to medium on the bone-in fried chicken and hot on the strips. And I got to say, it was fine. I mean, not it was fine in like the negative, it was fine sense, but like I did not have an issue with the level of spice whatsoever.
It really is, this is no offense to Maono. It's their hot is not that hot. You know,
I mean, they do have two levels up from hot that you can go.
Two levels? There's not a single level?
I'm pretty sure it's two levels.
How do you have two levels beyond hot? I'll accept one. You can have mild, medium, hot, and then one extreme beyond that.
I mean, take it up with Maono. Please don't actually take it up with Maono, but I'm just informing you that there were two other options. There's a... Let's see here. Why is this not pulling down? Oh, I guess there's only one level up. It's only extra hot.
Thank you. Thank you for that, for confirming that. But like the Sisters and Brothers mild is hotter than the Maono hot, for the record. I mean, it's a different type of thing. This isn't Nashville hot chicken.
No.
So you know, I don't know if there's really that much of a lineage in Hawaiian style fried chicken of being that spicy. But it would make sense to me if there was, but it's not a supremely hot fried chicken, but you like a little bit of spice.
There's some kick.
On there.
I mean,
yeah. You want a little bit of spice on there. And so I kind of ravenously ate this chicken. I mean, I ate
four really
pieces of chicken. And, you know, a lot of people talk about game planning for buffets or whatever. And I felt like I'd eaten too big of a lunch. I was worried I wouldn't have an appetite. 4 or 5 pieces of fried chicken. And I was wrong. I definitely had the appetite for that much chicken. Ate it instantly. And so the 2 pieces of chicken strips, 2 pieces of fried chicken, had a breast and I believe a leg. And the thing that really stood out to me on the fried chicken, especially after being through the search, was it's not the Baka Buck double fried chicken, right?
No, but it is double fried.
Oh, it is. Okay.
It is,
that
yes.
Makes a lot of sense. Because that's what stood out to me, was just how crispy the fried chicken is.
I mean, what stood out to me is the level of flavor of the coating, the fried part of it. I mean, adding the spice only enhances it, but it is noticeably, I think, more flavorful than the vast majority, and particularly probably in comparison to the previous week, was probably an element of that too. It is extremely flavorful. So the thing I'll say about the fried chicken, it is also super greasy, and I don't love greasy fried chicken.
Super greasy, interesting.
Oh, yeah. Which is part of the reason that I've migrated to the chicken strips or the chicken sandwich instead, which are not as notably greasy, but still, like, I mean, like, if a flake of the breading falls off, you got to make sure to eat that on its own. And it's just incredible by itself.
Wow.
You don't feel that way?
And I thought it was good. I think you like this a little bit more than I do. And I just didn't get that much flavor from it. I'm a little surprised.
What?
I'm a little surprised that you felt like it was that flavorful. I mean, to me, it's D-N-E was the
D-N-E,
place in
yes.
Pioneer Square that we went to. That one was just like, wow, there's flavor here. Both in the chicken itself and also the rosemary flavor. That was just like undeniable in that one. This didn't have any particular one flavor, which is not necessarily a bad thing, where you could be like, wow, this really stands out. Or the juiciness of the chicken, where you're like, damn, that chicken itself, they brine it perfectly, such as the cookies, fried chicken. I think I actually prefer a slightly less fried. I don't know if the double fried is quite my favorite, because I think that the slightly less fried, single fried, I think it allows for the flavor in the fry to come out a little bit more. Here you get a little bit more of the crunch.
I don't agree with this at all.
And I like the crunch, but to me, the Maono chicken was extraordinarily close. But I think it is a tier behind the cookies country chicken and the D&E chicken.
Well, we 100% are going to have to agree to disagree on this, because
wow,
Maono got the highest score of any location we've been to thus far for me.
I am shocked.
And I will say, we haven't talked a lot about the strips. I would say that the strips to
the
me
strips
were
also were excellent.
They were a better balance of flavor and, you know, the texture and everything that I want there. But one of the things you're not mentioning, I think to me, the chicken is just like perfectly cooked. Like the chicken itself on the inside is probably not quite as flavorful as the D&E chicken was, but it's just so edible because of the fact that it's the perfect level of moisture.
Man, I don't know. That the cookies chicken kind of ruined me on it a little bit. It's like the standard is so high now.
So I awarded this a 94.
I think it is a 91. I mean, it was a phenomenal eating experience. This is definitely not anything negative about Maono at all. It was, it just, the first bite that I had, and I'm only, if I hadn't had the cookies chicken, I'd probably feel different. But that first bite that I had, I bit into it, and this wasn't fresh, by the way. You went and picked that up in Pioneer Square, drove to your house, and then I got it from your house. So this wasn't like I had it instantly out of the box. The cookies.
I see.
Yeah. So it wasn't like I just grabbed it and it was piping hot right away. It maintained that flavor inside. And it's something that it's like fucking Rosebud. You know what I mean? Like, I'm trying to find that feeling again of biting into that chicken for the first time. Every single meal that I have, I say to myself, can I recreate that experience? And this did not quite get there. It was the greatest fried chicken experience that I've ever had in my entire life.
Wow. Well, I would say, even though we're probably about halfway through our search for Seattle's best fried chicken.
Wow. We're only halfway through, but yeah. But also I love that it's getting hotter out, because the chicken's only going to start to taste better.
I mean, I think it's pretty clear that Maono, D&E, and Cookies are all going to advance to the tournament round of this.
I mean, we know that June Baby is going to be.
We're expecting I don't know what the number is going to be, because Super Six was a very strong contender as well. Oh, man. I mean, Super there's been several.
Fucking good. Damn.
It's going to be a tough decision, but all of those I think we need to eat again in comparison to each other.
I would love to do that.
me too.
Well, I also want to mention that and first up, an incredible eating experience at Maono all around. Just I think everything that Maono does is borderline perfect. I didn't even get to eat a daikon pickle for this. You don't even eat them, and they're really the perfect food. So I'm going this weekend. However, I'm making the pilgrimage down south, and first off, I'm going to In-N-Out in Kaiser, Oregon.
I'm jealous, but I've been to In-N-Out more recently, I think, than you have.
Have you?
I went in Las Vegas in December 2019.
Oh. I went in November 2019.
Okay.
So it wasn't that much more recently. And I might have been in February. I might have been in February of 2020. I don't remember. So
you don't remember?
I don't think that I did. But I can't say with 100% certainty. Anyway. First off, if anybody has any sneaks involving the In-N-Out in Kaiser, Oregon, I have heard that it is an incredible line. as being the northernmost In-N-Out, I feel like there are a lot of people who are going to be making this pilgrimage on this Sunday when it's going to be 80 degrees.
Checks out.
So we'll see. If anybody has any sneaks, I'm open to receive them. But also, as we've gotten into the search for Seattle's best chicken, I felt like it makes a lot of sense to go check out the finest chicken from our neighbors to the south in Portland, Oregon, at Screen Door. And I'm excited to, after we've had these conversations and we've really critically viewed fried chicken, to have Screen Door fried chicken, because to you, it would be the number one chicken if it were in Seattle.
I mean, again, we haven't tried June Baby. We haven't gone through all of the Seattle options, but Screen Door would rate ahead of any chicken, fried chicken we've had in Seattle. Yes, without question.
Okay.
Which is part of the reason that, like, you awarded a 97 to Cookies. I haven't gone that high on my scale, because to me,
wow,
Screen Door is setting the curve.
I'm telling you, if Screen Door is as good as Cookies, I'm fucking moving to Portland. I'm sorry. You better get ready to start talking about the Timbers.
Well, we are fucking no way we are talking about the Timbers. I'm happy to talk about the Blazers with you, but
okay, yeah, we'll pivot to a full Portland basketball podcast. That's fine. Going into the Pelton Cast Hall of Fame.
Oh, wow. Portland State's finest.
We like Kyle Singler was really underrated. You know, if you reevaluate his NBA career, Dennis Erickson is going to be the new Steve Sarkisian.
I mean, is that not the case for us in Seattle? Like, Dennis Erickson is part of our lineage too.
Oh yeah, we've got both. There we go.
He's Northwest through and through.
Let's remember the Oregon State team that had Chad Johnson, TJ Houshmandzadeh, and
I don't understand how you're going to have gone to a different college because you moved to Portland.
It doesn't matter.
You could be in Portland and be a UW alum. It has happened.
Nope.
Did they Nigel, have, Nigel Burton is like doing radio down there.
And well, also Jordan Kent.
What also Jordan Kent in what sense?
Seahawks legend. That sense. Who was the running back that they had? It wasn't, this was pre-Steven Jackson, right?
Ken Simonton.
Ken Simonton. Wow. There we go. Anyway, this is going to be
oh, boy.
We won't go as far as to be a Ducks pod, but I'd be happy to be a Beavs pod.
Well, I mean, look.
We're gonna all of a sudden get really into college baseball.
The enemy of my enemy is my friend.
Do they still have a good college baseball team?
I assume Oregon State? So, yeah.
There we go.
I'm not specifically following
Gary, it. Gary Payton, too, can still be in the Hall of Fame.
And GP, too.
There we go.
Currently on a 10-day with the Warriors. Shouts to GP, too.
And also Steven and Ethan Thompson.
lifelong Tinkle fans.
Oh, man.
Anyways, you're going to go to Screen Door when you're in Portland.
What I'm trying to say is I'm going to get chicken in Portland.
And then we're going to talk about it next week. I mean, I'm jealous. I have not been to Portland since late February 2020. It's been way, way too long since I've been to Portland. And obviously,
all of this reminiscing about their brilliant, was it the Fiesta Bowl that they beat Notre Dame?
Yes.
All this reminiscing, we did a whole remember the 2001 season for Oregon State just to say that I'm going to Screen Door this weekend.
I don't understand how they're connected, but okay, go for it. Should we talk about Seattle sports?
There we go.
Let's start by talking about Isaiah Thomas with an update. My ESPN colleague reported, Andrew Lopez reported on Tuesday that Thomas will not be signed to a second 10-day contract at this point. The Pels still dancing with the luxury tax, but may also have more of a need on the wing due to some injuries there. Josh Hart's, I believe, out for the season, and Nikhil Alexander-Walker has missed some time. Thomas played 3 games for the Pelicans on his 10-day, scoring 23 points in 48 minutes, but on... I've dropped the field goals, but I think it's 9 of 27 shooting with 5 assists and 6 turnovers in his return to the NBA. So we'll see if we see him again this season in New Orleans. A brief update on the Seattle Kraken. GM Ron Francis told reporters the team is looking to hire a head coach in the second quarter of this year or within the next 2.5 months. That timing obviously makes sense in terms of coming before the expansion draft in the NHL, but also potentially after postseason coaching changes take place and they see who all is available on the market. We have no M's hot takes this week, but an update is Scott Servais announced Tuesday that James Paxton will undergo Tommy John surgery after suffering an elbow injury in his first appearance of 2021 last Tuesday. That surgery will obviously end Paxton's season in his return to the Mariners on a 1-year deal.
You're my boy, Maple.
So that's a bummer.
Watching, I like tuned into the Mariners game right as James Paxton got injured. I like watched 2 pitches. He got hurt. And then it was just like kind of awkward silence in the booth as everybody was like, that's a bad sign. I felt like people got it. They were like, ooh, the velocity wasn't great there. Ah. And they were like, he's going to have to say something really special to get Scott Servais to get him to stay in this game, as if it was like a conversation. And I was like, his season is definitely done. Like, you could just see it in the moment, the way that he was responding. I think a pitcher knows. It was like he didn't want to let it go. And I think it would just be a devastating moment as a human being.
Yeah.
To be there and have suffered through all of these injuries. I mean, it's kind of why baseball is such a brutal sport, especially for pitchers. And you can have so much promise as a pitcher and it can just be gone instantly.
And it worked so hard to come back from previous injuries and then suffer another injury.
Well, and seeing him be there and just be like, fuck, you know? But then also you remember that they are generationally wealthy because this... And it's like, it's really hard seeing somebody as a human being, but also, you know.
It's certainly better than it could be in that regard. Well, the Sounders are getting ready to start the 2021 MLS season on Friday against Minnesota United FC, a rematch of last year's Western Conference Championship at 6:30 p.m. on FS1 on MLS opening day. The Sounders beat San Diego Loyal SC 1-0 in their second and final preseason match on Saturday behind a goal from Will Bruin. They dominated 22-2 in terms of shots, including 10 from Raul Ruiz Diaz in the second half alone because he came on at halftime, but couldn't find the finishing touch against Sounders keeper Trey Muse, who's on loan to the Loyal this season. With Nico Lodero unavailable due to minor injury, 19-year-old homegrown product Josh Atencio got the start in midfield and looks to be at the top of the line among young Sounders for playing time. Not great for my bold prediction that Ethan Dobelaire would be the Sounder who would break out of that group.
Who is the other very young player that they have?
Danny Leyva.
Yeah, so is Danny Leyva kind of pushed farther back? Because I felt like Danny Leyva was the hottest prospect that the Sounders had
2 years ago, for sure. Given his age, the fact that he was able to play at all with the first team was very exciting. But, you know, I feel like this is going to be kind of an ongoing competition for playing time in training all season, pretty much, from these guys. And there are some minutes there because midfield depth is by far the biggest question of this team, with Jordan Morris is, you know, first his transfer and now his injury. But, the 3-5-2 formation they've switched to this season certainly looks here to stay. So the projected starters for the Sounders coming into the season, you've got Bruin and Ruiz Diaz up top, with Freddie Montero also likely to play a key role at forward. He was the team's leading scorer in the preseason. You've got Lodero, Joao Paulo, and Christian Roldan as traditional midfielders, with Brad Smith and Alex Roldan as wingbacks. And then Javier Arriaga, Nuhu, and Shane O'Neill all got the start during the preseason as central defenders, with, of course, Stefan Fry in goal. You've got Yaimer Gomez Andrade, the team's most reliable center back last season. He's been with the second team thus far, but you assume will eventually push for playing time at center back and maybe push Nuhu out to left wing back at times. So you've really got, I would say, in that group, 12 reliable players or 13 reliable players, with, you know, Montero and the four center backs. And then it's a question of which of the young players step forward to join that group, with a lot of squad rotation needed in a year where you're going to have more congested schedule than normal due to the late start to the MLS season.
It is, you know, it's not fucking January 15th. So,
I mean, they started last year. The first game was March 1st.
I remember when the first game was.
Yeah, it was prior to the pandemic. That's the important thing. Or not prior, but prior to the stoppage of play due to the pandemic.
Prior to when everybody else acknowledged the pandemic. But your description of the formation that the Sounders are running as a 3-5-2 seems like it could very easily be a 5-3-2, depending on how you look at it. I mean, it's still a very defensive formation that we're talking about here.
Well, yeah. I mean, those starters at wing back, Brad Smith and Alex Ray, were like outside backs last year.
Traditional defenders, kind of, to a position where they're going to be playing wide. I'm surprised that, you know, Nuhu wouldn't be playing one of those positions.
Like I said, I think he's going to be in the mix at left back or left wing back as well.
Because it's a huge part of kind of his game, is being able to push forward. I mean, probably more so than being a central defender.
Yeah, it's an interesting shift for him, for sure. But you can't necessarily have both him and Brad Smith on the pitch in that kind of role. So I think that's part of it too, is getting both of those guys out there.
But definitely still a defensive focused, with kind of those star players a little bit more up front in the attacking position.
It's going to be interesting to see how it works out. Obviously, it's the big question about the Sounders season. Like, since Brian Schmetzer took over, he's been pretty loyal to the 4-2-3-1 formation. So it's a pretty dramatic change to go from playing, you know, I guess there's still five midfielders, but as you said, you know, two of them are traditional defenders. So, and to go from one up top to two forwards, it's basically a lineup we only saw in the past when the team was trailing. You'd go to that to try to put more offense on the pitch.
So you're imagining that Will Bruin and Ruiz Diaz will be starting, with Freddie Montero coming off the bench?
I think so.
Interesting, because I was imagining it with Freddie starting and Bruin still kind of playing that relief role.
I think Bruin has become really quite important to the team. I mean, as well as Montero did play, like I said, in the preseason, with Ruiz Diaz arriving late to training camp, Bruins' ability to be a play like a hold up style and be a different kind of target as a forward contrasts a little more with how Rui Diaz plays than I think Montero and Rui Diaz are more similar to each other. So I think that's part of why I expect that.
Interesting. Yeah. I mean, it's definitely a different dynamic for the team. And losing Jordan Morris, I think is part of that, where Jordan Morris, you know, he's an attacking player, but he's very good with the ball on his foot. And he's somebody who kind of has those abilities that translate between the midfield and also in an attacking position. So, and Will Bruin is not necessarily that, you know. It'll be fascinating to see how this team looks different. And I think they probably are a weaker squad than they were a year ago.
Yeah, I think that's hard to dispute at this point. I mean, Jordan Morris had emerged as one of the best players in MLS. So you're not going to be able to replace him with Freddy Montero, who's not at that star stage of his career anymore. So, and they've also lost some other depth. Gustav Svensson is gone. Roman Torres didn't play a lot during the postseason, but he's gone. Jovan Jones started throughout their playoff run. He's gone. So they've lost a lot of experience depth, and that's where one of the big keys to the season, besides how well the formation works, is the ability of that young group to step forward. And that's something that those guys haven't really had an opportunity that much the last couple of seasons. Brian Schmetzer has definitely preferred to rely on the veterans, but now he's got no choice, I think, but to play those guys on a regular basis.
It's April. You know what I mean? Like,
true.
The season is just starting. This is not going to be the Sounders team we're going to see in October.
It's very possible they could go out and add another midfielder. That's very possible. So that's also all the more pressure, I think, on the young players to show that they deserve those minutes and they don't need that kind of addition there.
Well, and with Jordan Morris going, and is he off the salary cap or whatever as far as a designated player?
He was never a designated player, I'm pretty sure. I'm sure of that. He was on allocation money, basically. But yeah, they do get his salary from the loan offset, even though he is back from it and rehabbing here. But the expectation was you were going to get, you know, a transfer fee from him mid-season, and that might be something you'd reinvest into replacing him. And now that presumably is not going to happen.
And there will be fans at the stadium?
There will be fans at the stadium, yes. I forget what the attendance number they announced was. I want to say 7,500. There also will be fans at attendance at OL Reign's first match, but that'll just their first match because Pierce County was sent back to phase two, whereas King County remained in phase three of the reopening plan in the state of Washington. So, you know, we continue to navigate this, all of us.
All right. Well, tell us more about OL Reign.
Well, let's first quickly mention Minnesota, who returns 10 of 11 players from the starting 11 last December that lost 3-2 to the Sounders in the Western Conference Championship at Lumen Field. Their lone loss from that group was midfielder Kevin Molino, who signed with Columbus in free agency after scoring 9 goals last season. Would say still, though, the Loons generally projected to take a step back after finishing 4th in the West last season before that playoff run.
Question for you in general about MLS. Are there new teams joining MLS this season, as has been the case for the past handful of years?
Austin is joining MLS this season.
And that's Austin FC?
Yep.
And are they in the Western Conference or the Eastern?
They are in the Western Conference, yes.
All right. This is exciting. Do you know where they're playing in Austin?
I assume they've constructed a soccer-specific stadium, but that's you've gone outside of my Austin knowledge.
Okay, I saw an update on, I believe, ESPN's Bottom Line yesterday, which I missed the first part of, and I'm hoping that you, as ESPN's Kevin Pelton, can fill me in. And I saw that there was an issue potentially with Sacramento's bid for an MLS team. Can you explain to me what's going on there?
Yeah, Sacramento, it appears, is out as an expansion franchise.
Really? Wow. Yeah. Well, if David Stern was around, he'd sure keep them. He'd figure out a way.
Well, if Vivek Ranadive steps forward with the money, then perhaps they can be back in. But there's no shortage of interest for that franchise.
Do you know what ended up happening with the Sacramento bid?
The money fell through, basically.
Interesting. Who are some of the other possible candidates to pick up that franchise?
San Diego, Las Vegas, I think are two teams that have been mentioned.
Oh, man. Let's get a team in Vegas. I want every sports team in
Vegas. I guess Sacramento is not officially out. It's indefinite hold is the decision, because Ron Burkle, who was going to be the primary financier behind that, who was originally going to be the money behind Sacramento's bid to keep the Kings before Vivek Ranadive emerged as that in that role.
Where's Mayor Kevin Johnson right now?
Well,
is he still the mayor of Sacramento?
No.
Not for a long time.
No. So Vegas, San Diego, Phoenix, another candidate.
A little surprising that Phoenix doesn't have an MLS team at this point.
It's definitely one of the bigger markets without one. So the two current expansion franchises that are on the way are Charlotte and St. Louis.
There's going to be so many fucking MLS teams.
Well, hopefully eventually that means we'll have promotion and relegation, but yes.
Or two teams in Seattle.
Oh.
Oh, man. Imagine choosing the allegiance between the Sounders and like a Tacoma team or something.
The Defiance get promoted to MLS.
It would be kind of fun, right?
It would be quite a rivalry. You thought Portland was a rivalry.
If we could have promotion and relegation, if they were just like, we've awarded 50 franchises or whatever.
I don't think it has to be that many.
Or 40, and they're like, we're going to have 20 in MLS A and MLS B or whatever. That would be pretty fun if there was like an actual, it would feel European style where there was like an actual rival. You know, like Portland is one thing, but like Tacoma would be another thing.
I don't know if Tacoma is still with one of the top 40 markets. With all due respect to Tacoma.
Wow.
Besides, Tacoma already has soccer at the highest level. And that
there
is,
we go.
As you mentioned,
there's your transition.
Oh, well, rain until they inevitably move. and they also open their season Friday, taking on the Houston Dash at 7 p.m. on Paramount Plus. Because of the NWSL Challenge Cup conference format, so teams are only playing teams within their own conference in the Challenge Cup this year, which is in home stadiums instead of in a single location like it was last year in their bubble in Salt Lake City. The Rain were the lone Western Conference team not to open their season last weekend. So Houston drew 0-0 at home against Chicago Red Stars in a rematch of last year's Challenge Cup final, which was won by Houston. Hmm. The Dash also finished second behind Portland in last year's fall series, the other NWSL action we saw, because they didn't play a traditional regular season or playoffs. Megan Rapinoe not expected to play for OL Reign after a busy weekend. She converted the lone goal from the spot for the U.S. Women's National Team in last Saturday's 1-1 draw at Sweden in a friendly, and then converted another penalty on Tuesday as the USWNT won 2-0 in France.
Man.
Houston,
Megan Rapinoe is like Nego Case playing with the new pornographers. Like, it's just like you would love to see her play with OL Reign, but like she's got other plans. Look, she's busy.
Well, a lot of people are busy with USWNT in this case. Houston likely will be without Christy Mewis and possibly goalkeeper Jane Campbell, as they were also part of the U.S. Women's National Team squad this week.
You're not going to get the full Wu-Tang Clan.
Hopefully next weekend for Megan Rapinoe in her first match for OL Reign since 2019.
Then next weekend, once we've moved back to phase two in Tacoma or in Pierce County.
Yes, you won't be able to go. You won't be able to attend.
The Wu-Tang Clan.
But you can watch it on Paramount Plus.
There might be rumors it's a fake Ghostface Killer.
Oh, no. All right, we got a bunch of news on the Seattle Storm, starting with them unveiling three new jerseys as part of Nike's overhaul of WNBA jerseys last week. Teams will again have traditional white jerseys after those were phased out in 2015, along with a primary dark one, which will be green for the Storm, and a third Rebel edition along the lines of the NBA City Edition jerseys. The Storm's is black, the first time they've worn black jerseys, with a sash-like swoop symbolizing female empowerment. The primary jerseys nod a bit toward the jerseys the Sonics wore during their last seven seasons in Seattle, with a broad stripe along the side of the jerseys and shorts, although those now connect to a splash of secondary color above the team/city name rather than the rainbow underneath those like the Sonics traditionally had. I see you're skeptical. You clearly have seen this.
Describing these words, it's just like you could literally just link to a photo and be like, look,
jerseys also restore the player numbers and team city names back on the front of jerseys after those were replaced in recent years with a logo and more prominent jersey sponsorship than we have now.
Also, I'm an old man, but like, how do they not have white home jerseys?
You know, they were trying shit.
Just like the fucking Blazers, they've got Miami Heat jerseys now. I like that the actual Miami Heat have just been like, we're wearing our Miami Vice jerseys so anybody can have red and black jerseys.
I mean, gray and black, I don't know if specifically.
There is no traditional color left in the NBA for jerseys.
Yeah, that's definitely true. Except like the Celtics, maybe.
Ugh,
so God.
Don't bring up that name.
Well, true.
What was that fucking shot that Dame took at the end of the game? That was
from 90 feet?
No. The long jumper when they were down one. It was just like, who called this?
You know, I mean, it's worked out very well for them over the course of the season.
A long two? Did Carmelo whisper in his ear and be like, hey.
I mean, they were down one at that point, weren't they?
They were. You don't take a long two no matter the situation. Even if you're down one, a three is better than a long two.
I mean, it's a better. I don't think the difference is that dramatic.
Drive to the fucking hoop, Dame. You're better shooting it from 40 feet away than a long two. I blame Carmelo for this.
Yeah, Carmelo played quite well on Tuesday.
Did he?
Yeah.
That shot was terrible. That was the worst Dame time shot I think I have ever seen.
Clearly not as worked up about this as you are. So the WNBA has announced its schedule.
You're not on my Portland podcast.
Oh, no. WWE announced its schedule on Tuesday. The Storm will open the season with a home set against the Las Vegas Aces, a rematch of last year's WNBA Finals. Starting off by handing out championship rings on Saturday, May 15th at noon, which will presumably be on ABC. That hasn't been announced yet, the national TV schedule. And then Tuesday, May 18th as well.
Kelsey Plum still on the Las Vegas Aces?
She is and should be back this year from the Achilles injury that kept her out in 2020.
All right.
All games this season will be at the Angel of the Winds Arena, not Casino, in Everett, with the Climate Pledge Arena not scheduled to open until October, per a Seattle Times report last week. No details yet on fans in attendance, a bridge we've yet to cross in terms of indoor arenas, because, you know, basically it's just been prep sports and college sports where the Pac-12 is not allowing full attendance. So this will be the first professional sport to play indoors in the Seattle area since the pandemic started. So that's going to be interesting to see how they handle that. The WNBA schedule reduced from the planned 36 games, which was going to be an increase from 34 starting last year when they ended up playing 22 in the bubble, to this year it's going to be 32 games in the regular season to fit everything in with an Olympic break between July 11th and August 15th and leave room for possible postponements during the pandemic. The regular season will wrap up Sunday, September 19th, though the Storm finishes up that Friday by hosting the Phoenix Mercury. All right, a little overseas news. Storm newcomer Katie Lou Samuelson was chosen to the All-EuroLeague Women first team. Exciting progress for her compared to what she's done in the WNBA so far, with Brianna Stewart on the second team. So,
wow.
Better than Brianna Stewart. Katie Lou Samuelson, the best Storm player.
I was going to ask if Brianna Stewart was pushing Lauren Jackson to potentially be the best player in Seattle basketball history, but second team All-EuroLeague team.
Yeah, clearly rule it out now. Write it off. The Storm also announced on Tuesday that Talisa Rhea has been promoted from assistant GM to GM ahead of Thursday's WNBA draft. Rhea, who played college basketball at Oregon State and Seattle U, has been part of the organization since 2015. Oh, yeah.
No, Beavs.
Well, you know, there's a Beaver transfer in this year's WNBA
draft.
That's
Beaver legend to Lisa Rhea to you.
Oh, wow. I don't know if you're going to endorse the Oregon State transfer in this week's WNBA draft for the Storm. She's a possibility. Alicia Valvanis relinquished the GM duties but remains president and CEO for the Storm. So the draft is coming this Thursday. The Storm will pick 11th, having traded the number one overall pick to Dallas for Katie Lou Samuelson after acquiring it in their sign-and-trade deal, sending Natasha Howard to the New York Liberty. Several Pac-12 prospects, I think, possibly in the mix for the Storm. Ari McDonald, after leading Arizona the title game, likely to go much higher, but Stanford guard Keanu Williams and transfer Dejanay Carrington, who ended up at Baylor last year and also played in the Final Four, And then, or in the Elite Eight, I guess they got eliminated. And then UCLA forward Mikayla Onyenwere also expected to go in the back half of the first round, along with the aforementioned Oregon State transfer Destiny Slocum, who played here last year for our old friend Mike Neighbors at Arkansas.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so small world women's college basketball.
I guess so. I'm not a fan, though, because she transferred from Oregon State.
Well, so did Talisa Rhea.
Wait, what?
She finished up at Seattle U.
It's a big mistake.
I mean, there was
much
some
better
reasons.
Institution there in Corvallis.
we're not gonna go into what happened to the Beavers program at that point when they lost basically their entire team before Scott Ruick came in and turned them into a powerhouse.
Wow, was Mike Hopkins their head coach?
Well, all right. UW softball took 3 of 4 against. Oh, you're gonna be upset about this against a surprisingly tough Oregon State team. Scoring just 9 total runs.
You did not imagine that Oregon State would come up this much on this.
No, podcast. I didn't really expect that was going to become a. You're going to be upset about UW beating Oregon State by the end of it. Naturally, the lone loss came in the nightcap of the doubleheader on Saturday with Kelly Lynch on the mound, though she pitched quite well, taking a no hitter into the seventh before giving up a walk off home run to lose that one. Gabby playing through 7 shutout innings in Friday's opening win, striking out 12. Again went the distance in Saturday's first game, striking out 13, but allowing 2 runs in the final inning after holding the Beavers hitless through 6 innings, same thing, before coming on in relief on Sunday to pitch 6 scoreless innings and get the win. Behind that performance, running her record to 20-0 this season, playing 1 Pac-12 Pitcher of the Week for the 4th time this year.
All right.
At 9-2, the Huskies are 2nd in the Pac-12 at the midpoint of the conference schedule behind 5-1 UCLA, which took a series against Oregon over the weekend. UW will play those 2 teams, the top 2 in the Pac-12, the next 2 weekends, starting by hosting the Ducks this weekend. Oregon 27-5 overall, having lost 1 at Oregon State like the Huskies in 4 of their 5 matchups against the Bruins. The Ducks dropped, based on those results, to number 5 in the ESPN.com USA softball rankings, with UW steady at number 6.
Oh, I hate those Ducks for so many reasons.
Oregon State, I believe, unranked.
Thanks for the update, though.
They're playing tough. They're giving these teams a hard time. Women's basketball update. So the...
There's so many random updates. You said that there would be. You're just going through them.
Things are happening. And it's mostly transfers at the college basketball level. So as UW was announcing, Tina Langley is his new coach last week. They also announced that the 3 leading scorers from last year's team, Haley Van Dyke, Quay Miller, and Tamia Sandler, have all submitted notifications of transfer. So I think one thing that's important to note here is just because you submitted notification of transfer, because we're not using the P word on this podcast anymore.
Wow.
Doesn't mean you have to transfer. It just means you have the ability to transfer. So Noah Dickerson did this when Lorenzo Romar was fired and replaced by Mike Hopkins, and he evaluated his options and then decided to come back to UW and finished his career here. So that's certainly a possibility as they get to know Coach Langley better that they may decide to stay, but they've given themselves the option to transfer. Mm-hmm. So
sometimes you injure the P word. It's like the weekend at the halftime of the Super Bowl, and you find your way through.
I feel like you might get lost and turn around and go back out in this case, in this metaphor.
Or that also.
So
sometimes it feels a little bit safer on the other side.
Also submitting a notification of transfer per The Athletic is Nancy Mulkey, the 6'9" Rice star who played for Langley the last 3 seasons, leading Rice to unprecedented heights in recent memory, and had originally declared for the WNBA draft last week before deciding to return for what will be a 6th year of eligibility for her. So we'll see if she decides to follow her coach to UW. That seems like it's a reasonable possibility.
Yeah.
UW men's basketball, we've seen several of their transfers choose new destinations. Eric Stevenson is headed to South Carolina and Raekwon Battle to Montana State. Previously, Nate Pryor had indicated he's headed to New Mexico State.
Okay, so these weren't, for the most part, there could be other players who were just, what is your term for this?
Notification of transfer?
Who've just submitted their notification of transfer, but...
I think in the UW men's basketball case, we can feel more confident that people are going to leave, including Hamir Wright, who I believe went on Noah Dickerson's podcast and talked about his frustrations with Mike Hopkins.
Doesn't sound like he's gonna be back. Noah Dickerson's got a podcast?
Yeah, I mean, you should be listening to that instead of listening to us, obviously.
Where's Noah Dickerson's podcast? Does he want to be part of the PN?
I guess he's on SI.com, so I feel like that might be a stronger network.
Is he really?
Yeah.
A like college role player has a podcast on SI.com and ESPN's Kevin Pelton can't even be?
God. Well, it is part of their local site network, basically.
Nobody had looking up the the podcast network for Noah Dickerson's podcast is one of the long pauses we are going to be having today.
Apparently, it does look like that's the case, yeah.
He's part of the local SI network podcast.
Yes.
Wow.
There you go.
Look at that. Well, okay, so he kind of, Hamir Wright aired out some of the issues that he had with Mike Hopkins. Did you listen to this?
I didn't listen to it. I read Percy Allen's article about it, and like basically said that I was stuck in my role and wasn't able to do more in terms of creating my own offense, and which seems like it's probably the appropriate role for Hamir Wright based on what we've seen. But also he indicated that Mike Hopkins had promised him a bigger role, you know, when he decided to come back for his senior year, and that those promises weren't fulfilled. So that's the bigger concern, I would say.
Yeah. And look, I think it could be a really tough balance of figuring out those things. But I do think that being upfront and having clear communication is one of the most important things that you can do as a college coach. And if Hamir Wright wasn't going to have the role that you were promising for him, I think you just have to let Hamir Wright know that that's not the role that you see for them. And I think that communication is going to be really valuable. And if Hamir Wright has that expectation heading into the season, then you can't have, and this is any player. I mean, I'm reading a lot into your description from reading Percy Allen's story about Hamir Wright being on Noah Dickerson's podcast.
It quotes Hamir Wright, so I've seen some direct quotes.
But I'm understanding that this is a big leap, but there have been a lot of players who have left the UW program this offseason. And I think that clear communication with these young athletes, student athletes, as commercials for the Pac-12 would like us to call them, having clear communication, I think, is really important. And it seems like whatever was happening, something was wrong at this program this year. It was
First off, we knew from the results that something was wrong.
But beyond that, there's a difference between being bad and Eric Stevenson transferring to South Carolina. Like, that's fucking weird, right?
Well,
you can't tell me that's not pretty strange. To just go to have started at Wichita State, come back home to UW, which made a lot of sense during a pandemic, and then transfer to an SEC school.
I was going
to
say South Carolina was a lot better, but they were not a lot better, as it turns out. I think they actually finished behind UW they finished five spots ahead of UW in the Pomeroy rankings.
It's a pretty weird transfer, right? Like that one to me, look, there's certain players who probably could have looked at their playing time and said,
yeah,
maybe I'm not part of this program long
term. I mean, I think Raekwon Battle and Nate Pryor found levels of play that is probably more appropriate for their skill sets.
Exactly. And that, I think, is whatever somebody wants to do is totally fine. But like playing at Montana State, New Mexico State, in a place where you're going to be able to start and potentially be a high-level player, that makes a lot of sense. Transferring to South Carolina after 1 year at your hometown school makes me think there's something going on here beyond this. And maybe it's a communication issue. I don't know. But it feels strange. And the fact that Hamir Wright felt the need, because these players, Hamir Wright doesn't need to justify transferring, right? Like, nobody needs to justify doing this. A lot of players transfer, but the fact that he felt the need to go on a Noah Dickerson's podcast and have this conversation, it makes me feel like there's an issue going on within the program more than just losing.
Well, I think losing can
exacerbate a lot of issues that a player might have, but there's more to it than that.
I mean, I think the other obvious issue that's happening here is that Mike Hopkins is feeling the heat. Like, he knows that the vast majority I don't want to say the vast majority because I haven't surveyed fans. A vocal contingent of Husky fans want a coaching change. So
he's not gonna. What does that have to do with not playing Hamir Wright for the role that he promised him, though? Like, I don't.
But it's,
that to me is, it's a different issue.
Fair, but I think so. One of the things that's happening is, like, if there's any ability to upgrade, they're going to take it right now. It's not about long-term solutions. It's about winning enough games next year to save your job.
I mean, this
and also the coaching staff is not the coaching staff anymore. We haven't seen an announcement on Dave Rice, but you know, Cameron Dollar is not part of the staff anymore. It looks like 2/3 of the assistant coaches are going to turn over.
This is the other issue, though, that happens. I didn't think we'd be getting into this conversation, but here we are. And the issue is, even caring about winning is kind of the incorrect way to look at this. If you're going to sell me on a scenario that all that really matters here, you can't pay the players because they're student athletes and they're getting an education, winning should not matter.
Oh, of course not.
And you basically can't have it both ways. And I feel like that's what's going on.
The Supreme Court may soon be telling the NCAA that they can't have it both ways.
I fucking loved reading about that. I'm like, wow, the Supreme Court, I'm like, all these people who I think are maybe the worst people on earth somehow agree with me. And you think of the Onion article, the worst person you know makes a really good point or whatever. And
just made, like, a really great point.
Yeah, and obviously got posted about a billion times on Twitter, but like, that was a really wild one. Where it's just like, man, we found the people who are worse than Republican politicians. And it is people who are in charge of the NCAA. There is actually something below Republican politicians. And it is people who are in charge of the NCAA. So, but these two things are antithetical to each other. Mike Hopkins should not be feeling the heat that he's pushing student athletes out of their college that they are attending classes at, because he's feeling
I don't know for sure that that's what's happening, that players are being I don't think that players are being, like, recruited over, because they haven't brought anyone in yet
other
than Terrell Brown Jr. So, you know,
but it is those two things, they should not be able to exist at the same time.
Of course not. If we're really about the student athlete experience, then it should be about the student athlete experience, not about wins and losses.
Yeah.
But it's not, because it's actually a big business, as it turns out.
It's a fucking corporation. The whole thing. It is a corporation, and it is funded like a corporation in a lot of ways, just with hidden money. Also, Sean Miller. Wow, that was kind of a wild one.
It was quite shocking, that he got fired. Did not think it was going to happen.
You know, it couldn't have happened to a better guy.
Well.
The shocking thing was that Sean Miller wasn't fired 4 years ago. It was like one of those celebrities where you're like, wait, he's been dead for 20 years, right? And then you look at it and you're like, wow, somehow still alive. And you're like, wow, Sean Miller is somehow still the coach of Arizona. Because I remember him being fired in 2018.
And
there's
yet
like there's a Mandela effect with Sean Miller as the head coach of Arizona basketball. I was like, they had like a massive violation, right? That everybody knew about.
Yeah.
There's like duffel bags of money.
I don't know about duffel bags necessarily.
Wasn't there a fucking documentary about this?
There was, yes.
And Sean Miller was still the head coach of Arizona.
He sure was.
You know, it's just all about the student athletes. That's really what I think about.
All right. So speaking of transfers.
God.
The Huskies have added another one to their football roster at receiver, adding former Michigan receiver Giles Jackson. An East Bay native who played 2 years in Ann Arbor, Jackson caught 24 passes for 309 yards and a touchdown. Also had 12 rushes for 74 yards and a touchdown. Saw action in 5 of the Wolverines' 6 games last season. Undersized at 5'9", but a major burner who led the Big Ten with 27.2 yards per kickoff return in 2020, nearly double the Huskies' conference low average of 15.5 yards per kickoff return, and took back 2 return TDs in one each of his 2 seasons at Michigan. Also returned punts in 2020, and he was excited to come to UW and team up with his cousin Vince Nunley, who's a 2021 UW recruit at safety.
There we go. Pretty exciting. You had me sold at East Bay.
Yes. I mean, you'd like it more if you were from Corvallis somehow, but well, I don't know. Is it Portland suburbs? Would you like Beaverton?
Lake Oswego?
Shouts to Peyton Pritchard.
Oh my God, no. We've gone too far with this.
Oh, found the line.
No, I mean, I don't know. He does have the lineage of... It's funny that I could dislike Peyton Pritchard so much, but
what lineage do you think he is?
Generally positive about Kevin Pritchard.
They're not related.
Wait, they aren't?
No, they're
not. He's not the child of Kevin Pritchard?
Nope.
Podcast is over. Are you kidding me?
I'm not kidding you.
They're unrelated?
They're unrelated.
Are you going to tell me that Jordan and Ernie Kent aren't related either?
They are related, yes.
A couple of fellow Oregon sports legends. that cannot be.
It's true.
Wow. All right.
Just happened to be two basketball NBA players named Pritchard who are not related to each other, despite the fact that Kevin Pritchard was in Oregon at the same time as Peyton Pritchard was like developing his game, I guess, honing his game.
This Giles Jackson transfer, though, I mean, position that UW really needed to find somebody, seems like they have the profile of a player who could be pretty exciting within this team.
Very much so. Yeah. All right, let's wrap up with the Seahawks, where the news we got last week was, I mean, obviously this isn't news, but Carlos Dunlap asked during his press conference announcing his re-signing about Russell Wilson and, you know, asking him about whether he was going to be part of the team. Quote, I did ask him if obviously he was going to be with us, because if I'm coming back because I see him as my quarterback and the rest of the team, I want to pick up where we left off. And he told me he's with us and he's here to stay. And he said, let's go Hawks. I'm not going to quote his every word. Those words are not his words verbatim, but those are my explanation of how I interpreted what he said.
Great. Let's go Hawks. I don't know. It's like such a non-news story, but I kind of love it. I feel like, what is he going to say to Carlos Dunlap? Right? If you're Carlos
Dunlap,
he doesn't
have to say anything now. I mean,
if your friend is like texting you and is just like, hey, are you going to be back with the Seahawks next year? You're Russell Wilson. You're like, I'm not going to cause a news story here. You're going to be like, let's go Hawks.
I mean,
or
if
whatever.
You actually want to get traded, you're going to cause a news story. But
Russell Wilson is Russell Wilson is smarter than to just cause the news story if he doesn't want it. He did it.
Did cause the news story, remember?
But he also, he didn't go as far as requesting a trade.
No.
You know, like Russell Wilson,
but there's a difference
very,
between
very careful about what he said.
There's a difference between, clearly he seems to have conveyed a level of excitement about being part of the 2021 Seahawks. To
Carlos Dunlap. He knows Dunlap. That he's going to be on the goddamn team next year, so he might as well have Carlos Dunlap on the team. You know what I mean? If he would have been like, yeah, I've got 1 year and then I'm gone. It's just such a hilarious news story to try to convey what one player said to another player, when really he'd be like, well, you know, the cap hit, if I were traded this offseason, doesn't make a lot of sense. Pete Carroll's also an older coach, so the chances of him trading me, it just doesn't really work out this year. But the following season, now that's not going to be what you're going to text to Carlos Dunlap.
There's a difference between being like, yeah, I'm going to be here this year, and he's with us and he's here to stay.
I believe that Russell Wilson is with us and he's here to stay. To me, this is the same as the Russell Wilson contract negotiation conversation. It's a non-conversation. At any point, have I ever acknowledged this? Have I ever acknowledged this?
That he might be traded?
Yeah. Maybe
I guess you
generally
didn't.
To the point of ignorance, I might have ignored this. But like I'm refusing to accept this conversation because it's not a conversation. Russell Wilson is not going to be traded. Like, and especially if he's not going to tell Carlos Dunlap if he's going to be traded. That's not where we're going to be finding out this news from. So, but at the same time, you know what? I love it. Here's my pivot to positivity.
Oh, wow.
Russell Wilson is here to stay. That's right. He caused a ruckus. He wanted to stir things up with the front office this offseason. He wanted to make sure that they went out and they protected Russell Wilson. They invested on offense. And you know what they did? They brought in Gabe Jackson. They solidified this offensive line. They brought back Chris Carson, safety net in the backfield for Russell Wilson, running back who he can trust, and another option at tight end. He can block. He can catch Gerald Everett. Like, what can't Gerald Everett do out there? Somebody who, I actually noticed this, the Seahawks drafted Malik McDowell a handful of picks right ahead of Gerald Everett.
That is correct.
And I feel like they've been trying to make up for that ever since, not going out and getting Everett with that pick. So going out and getting Gerald Everett himself was a huge move to solidify Russell Wilson this offseason. He's confident in this team. Look, both when you pair Gabe Jackson, Russell Wilson, Shane Waldron, and Carlos Dunlap together, you've got yourself a Super Bowl contending team. Thank you.
I didn't know we were doing Seahawks hot takes this week. That was... incredibly
I believe like 50% of this. I think Russell Wilson wanted to cause a stir, and he did, and everybody was in a little bit of an uproar. The Seahawks didn't react too much because I don't know, like what is an 80-year-old gonna react to? But like they went out and they invested a little bit at offensive line.
I feel like there's a Joe Biden joke in there somewhere.
But Russ doesn't want to leave Seattle. Like, I'm sorry, but Russell Wilson does not want to leave Seattle. At his core, he wants to be here. And we know this. We all know this. We've seen Russell Wilson. He wants to play his entire career with the Seahawks. And if he can play his entire career with the Seahawks, he will play his entire career with the Seahawks.
I mean, Mina Kimes was on the J.J. Redick podcast, The Old Man and the Three, a couple weeks ago.
Talking about how the fucking Seahawks offense was bad in the second half of this year and not blaming Pete Carroll.
That didn't come up.
Couldn't be me.
Like, the question that was put to her was basically like, why in the NFL can't guys force place their way to the place they want, like in the NBA? And I think that's the wrong way to think about it, because I don't think Russell Wilson wanted a trade. What he wanted was the Seahawks to be run the way that Russell Wilson wants them to be run.
Yes.
That was his plan.
Which is both true. And I mean, like, LeBron James can force his way wherever he wants to go, but he also forces teams to run the way that he wants them to run.
Yeah.
Russell Wilson is not LeBron James.
He is not.
If we're being honest. But like, the difference also, to answer that question, is contracts are very, very different in the NBA than they are in the NFL.
Well, in terms of trade specifically, yes.
Cannot force his way to another team. You know, like
if Russell Wilson like was like, I will never put on a Seahawks jersey again, I refuse to play for them. Yeah, I think the Seahawks would eventually trade him, no matter the cap ramifications.
Maybe,
but he doesn't. That's not where he's willing to go. So, well, I don't know if you saw what James Harden did. He basically held out without holding out.
But the NBA, it is a lot easier in the NBA. Like, if the Seahawks traded Russell Wilson, it would be, they'd have to get a much bigger haul than the Rockets got for James Harden.
I mean, if they could get four first round or three first round picks and three swaps, I can't remember what the exact number
apparently
was.
Apparently, you can't get that.
No, they can't. That's true. Unless you trade.
Shiel Kapadia informed us.
Actually,
we were unaware of.
He did. You know how they could get more draft picks than just three first round picks? They would have to trade Russell Wilson to the Jets.
I know. Yeah. But I think this is, it's probably the Carlos Dunlap scenario of it. I like that we're not talking about Russell Wilson right now. I like that there's not Seahawks news right now, because.
Well, there is Seahawks news. So that they're joining the Broncos and the Buccaneers and releasing a statement announcing their plans to opt out of voluntary OTAs in person as a group. A stance recommended by the NFL Players Association in favor of virtual offseason work. So that's the news.
Great. I agree with them.
But other than that, yes, pretty quiet on the Seahawks front as we record this a little over 2 weeks away from the NFL draft.
We'll get through the whole draft and it'll be pretty quiet on the
Seahawks. Oh, well. I've heard they might trade up to take a quarterback.
You can't joke about that.
Just said I've heard it.
Just a rumor that's going around.
It's analysis. Some people think it might happen. It might not. You never know.
Trade up to take a quarterback.
Oh, well, on that note.
Thanks for listening.
Thanks.